Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and the other respiratory tract infections that travel around the world this time of year. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I am bereft of news items. Still don't have fully updated CDC data on COVID and other upper respiratory infection disease levels. So I thought we would jump right into the mail bin. First question came in while we were speaking last week from Kelly. So her situation is a week out of date, but I think universal enough that your answer will probably be useful to other people. She writes, my husband traveled via airline to and from a conference last week, then tested positive for COVID on Saturday. He has been in quarantine in a separate room in our home since then. I haven't had any COVID symptoms and had a negative test this morning. My question is, how long should I avoid my usual activities of going to the gym and volunteering several times per week? So her question is, if she is being considerate to other people, how long does she have to be how considerate for?
Yeah, good for Kelly. That is, think about other people. We know that the what we call the incubation period of COVID, that is the period of time between when you're exposed and when you come to become ill, typically is 2 or 3 days with the types of subvariants that are circulating today. Could be a little longer, but typically it's going to occur 2 to 3 days, maybe 4 days. When you get beyond 4 or 5 days, it's unlikely you're going to come down with COVID, still possible up to 10. So that's the background knowledge that we have. What I would suggest to Kelly is that we're going to assume that it was last Saturday, so or the Saturday before last, excuse me. So I would assume that she's very unlikely to be contagious after 4 or 5 days. And that would be a period of time that if she's completely asymptomatic, she could feel fairly sure that she's not going to spread the virus to anybody. Now, there's something Kelly could also do, and that would be that when she's thinking that, well, I'm pretty much past the typical incubation period, while it's still possible for another 5 days, I'm going to do a test. I'll do a home test and see if it's positive. If it's negative, that doesn't tell you that you're not going to come down with COVID, but it adds further information that you won't. So I think that there's one other thing Kelly should consider beyond that, and that is what she's going to, who she is going to be having contact with. If it's going out doing other things, wear a mask for the next few days when you're indoors with other people. Or even if you're outdoors but walking with somebody closely, like when you came down with COVID, Brian, walking with a friend outdoors. So it's still possible outdoors. But if you're going to be with somebody who is older, well over 65, or younger but has underlying conditions that puts them at increased risk, I would avoid being with those people. Or if you have to be with those people, definitely have a good mask on, N95, KN95, for example, up until 10 full days. That's very conservative advice, but you don't want to get anybody else sick, so why not be conservative?
And good on you, Kelly, for not wanting to get anyone else sick. We would have less disease in circulation if everyone were as scrupulous as you. The phone number, if you want to put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg, is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. We are taking questions about COVID, influenza, RSV, all the other upper respiratory tract infections that go around this time of year. I have something, not that serious, but hasn't popped up positive on any of the home tests. You can probably hear it in my voice. Dr. Swartzberg, our next question comes from Steve, no city mentioned. He writes, I received an RSV vaccination 2 years ago. The CDC's webpage says that these last at least 2 years. My Kaiser physician says the CDC does not recommend a second vaccination. Do you know how long these vaccinations are effective?
Well, Steve, I don't know how long they're effective. I do know that they remain effective for at least 3 years. We have data now. The vaccines have been out a little over 3 years now, so we know that people who got vaccinated 3 years ago still have good protection 3 years out. So there's no need for an additional booster, and I think that's what your Kaiser doctor is referring to. Now, what we don't have yet is 4 years out. Are you still protected at 4 years? We have seen over the 3 years a slight decline over time in terms of the amount of protection you have, and that likely will continue. And at some point, we're going to be below the level where we feel we have optimal protection for a population who's been vaccinated. And at that point, a booster is going to be recommended, but not at this point yet. So anybody who's been vaccinated previously for RSV is still good for at least 3 years.
Any reason to think the vaccine wouldn't be like, say, the flu or COVID vaccine, where the decline in effectiveness is only gradual and incremental? You still enjoy the majority of the benefit for the outcomes you really care about, like hospitalization and death, well after any tapering off point?
Yeah, I mean, we could very well see that, Brian. We just don't know yet. The Achilles heel for RSV, from our perspective, is that unlike COVID, unlike influenza, it doesn't mutate really fast. And so that's a big reason why our vaccines against COVID and influenza have to be updated on a regular basis. We haven't seen that for the virus RSV. So again, right now we're okay. We may have longer protection. Tune in late summer next year, and we'll have some good advice, hopefully.
All right, let's take a couple from the phone lines before we go back to the inbox. First up, we have John in El Sobrante. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I wondered if it was okay to ask a question about the shingles vaccine, the Zoster vaccine. Is it possible to ask a question about that?
Go for it, John.
Okay. Well, I am 73. I have had shingles in the past, and I'm have heard it's a two-shot regimen, and perhaps the couple in their 80s last week talked about coming for a second shot might have been the shingles shot. But I'm fearful in getting it. My brother said it was the worst shot he'd ever had. And is it, being 73, and I do have a type of CLL, of leukemia, is it really important that I get it? The doctor's opinion on the shingles vaccine, which is a fairly mean shot, I hear. Thank you.
Sure. John, your brother's experience with the shingles shot is not atypical. People do get significant reactions to it. Not life-threatening reactions, but you can be pretty miserable for 24, 48 hours, sometimes even longer, with body aches, fever sometimes, sometimes nausea and vomiting. Now, that said, a lot of people who get the vaccine don't experience any of these side effects, but the shingles vaccine certainly can cause that. So your brother's experience, as I said, is not atypical. So should you get it? Well, the pithy answer is absolutely yes. And the reason for that answer is, number one, of course, you don't want to come down with shingles. It's for those people who have had it, which is roughly 10 to 15% of the adult population, will get shingles at sometime in their life. It's a miserable infectious disease. It causes a lot of pain. And in a very small percentage of people, that pain doesn't go away for weeks, months, and in a very small percentage of people, that pain doesn't go away, period. And that can be a disaster for the rest of your life. So protecting yourself against getting a case of shingles with the vaccine is reasonable just for that reason. The fact that you have CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, does put you at a little greater risk of coming down with shingles and a very small risk of shingles vaccine, of shingles infection, not limiting itself to just the skin, which is the typical case with shingles. It can sometimes, particularly in people whose immune systems don't work as well, it can sometimes disseminate to other organs in the body, causing pneumonia, hepatitis, encephalitis, meningitis, etc. Now, CLL is, most people with CLL aren't that immunosuppressed to develop what we call disseminated shingles or disseminated zoster, but you are at a little bit increased risk for that. So that's another reason to consider it. And then there's a third reason that the story is still unfolding, but is pretty compelling now. And that is when you get shingles, when the virus reactivates and causes that infection on the skin, it causes a generalized inflammatory response in your body. And that generalized inflammatory response in your body can damage further, for example, blood vessels. And we're seeing now a significantly higher risk of having a heart attack or stroke within a year of having had shingles. So it turns out that not just shingles, but some other infectious diseases as well, after that infection, it puts you at increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So to prevent cardiovascular disease, help prevent you having a stroke or a heart attack, don't get shingles. To protect you against that unlikely event of disseminated zoster, which can be very, very serious, get vaccinated. To prevent you from getting really a lot of pain from that shingles, and sometimes that pain can be persistent, get vaccinated. So I gave you my pithy answer. Absolutely yes, and that's the long answer.
Dr. Swartzberg, early in his question, John mentioned that he has already had shingles as an adult one time. How much lingering protection from prior disease is there?
We don't think that there's any lingering protection. It used to be thought that if you had a case of shingles, you were protected from getting another episode. But the data over the last 20 years or so, the epidemiologic data suggests that that's not the case. And if you've had one episode of shingles, you're at comparable risk of having another episode. You're not at greater risk, but you're not at lesser risk. So you're back to square one with that.
All right, John, great question. Thank you for calling in with it. Let's go to Oakland next, where Lisa is on the line. Good morning, Lisa.
Thanks, Brian. I have a question, and an article I read in the New York Times said that they're discovering that COVID can have long-term organ effects in some people, in the heart, in the gut, in the lungs, and it's not long COVID. It's just something that can be cumulative to lead to heart attacks or, and I think they think the basis is widespread inflammation. Anyhow, I'm just wondering how widespread that is because I see a lot of people are not concerned with getting COVID. They're just pretty much like, I'll get COVID, I get better. But it seems to imply that people are not actually getting better, but that there's more hidden damage in some cases than people are aware.
Thank you, Lisa. That's a nice description of what we have relatively recently learned about one of the complications of having COVID. Now, as you said, it's relatively rare, and we don't really know how often that occurs. But just as I was talking about with the previous caller, John, about shingles, we know that after having COVID, yes, you can get long COVID, which one of the hypotheses for long COVID is that it causes ongoing inflammation and that can damage blood vessels. So one of the things that may happen after an episode of COVID in a small number of people is that they go on to develop increased risk of having cardiovascular disease. And we don't know much more about it than that, but we know this is from epidemiology. We do know that there appears to be in some people an increased risk for those events happening up to a year and maybe longer, maybe 2 years. So your point is really well made. We don't know enough about this infectious disease to really confidently say what are the long-term consequences of having it. We know that the vast majority of people, after going on close to 6 years now, have not had long-term complications, but we also know that there's a substantial number of people that do have long-term problems. Long COVID, we call it, but what that is not completely clear yet. So it's just another argument for trying to not get infected with this virus if you can avoid it. And therefore, it's another argument for protecting yourself with all the things we know, including vaccination.
Dr. Swartzberg, if I'm not mistaken, Lisa was making the point that it's not just that you could get a chronic inflammatory condition after an infection, but that the acute infection itself, the systemic inflammation that might accompany that, could just do enough damage while you're sick to cause lasting health effects. You might not notice it subjectively, but it would show up epidemiologically as something like heightened risk of heart attack and stroke.
Absolutely, Brian. Thank you for clarifying that. That's what I was referring to, but didn't say very clearly, that when you get this acute inflammatory disease from an infectious disease, it can have significant effects outside of just the respiratory tree where you have been infected. And one of the things is inflammation in the blood vessels that could increase your risk of a heart attack or stroke. So thank you.
All right. Let's go to the peninsula next, where James is on the line in Palo Alto. Good morning, James.
Hi, good morning. My question is a COVID-regarded question. I'm going to be traveling to New York City in January. I haven't received a vaccine yet, although I've been vaccinated several times during the height of the pandemic. I'm wondering, my question is, if I would wear a mask for sure, would that help to some extent on the flight, preventing me from getting infected with COVID? And it would
Dr.
be
a
N95, you know, the best mask I could get.
James, yes, the answer is yes. The N95 mask fit correctly, so you're not getting any leaks, gives you very good protection. Not 100%, but it gives you very good protection. And one of the riskiest things you can do in terms of getting infected with the virus that transmits through the air, like COVID, influenza, RSV, is to wear a mask in high-risk situations. And the airport is one of those situations. And the airplane, especially when you're on the tarmac, when you don't have a lot of air circulating, but really for the whole flight, you're at increased risk of inhaling the virus that somebody else has. You know, the earlier caller was really concerned about when she could go out after and be safe because her husband had COVID. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't have that attitude about protecting other people. And so on the airplanes, you're going to encounter lots of people who have respiratory tract infections, particularly in January, where we will be in the height of influenza season, in the height of RSV season, and we don't know what COVID's going to be like at that time. So I think it's a very good idea. I would definitely wear a mask in the airport, on the airplane.
And just to emphasize what Dr. Swartzberg said, most people focus on the airplane because you're in a tight, confined space with other people. When it's in flight and there's maximum air circulation in the cabin, that air is moving through pretty good filters. That is less risky than when you are in what feels like a big, airy airport terminal surrounded by lots of other people, or when you're sitting on the tarmac before the plane's air circulation system has moved up to full throttle. All right, Dr. Swartzberg, let's go back to the inbox for one final question. Eliza in Simi Valley wrote in to ask, if I'm making a vaccine appointment for this fall and my pharmacy has all three COVID vaccines, Sounds like she's a bit of a connoisseur. Nuvaxovid, mNEX spike, and Comirnaty to choose from. Which vaccine might be best and why?
Well, most important thing, of course, is getting vaccinated. And they all give good protection. There's been a lot of interest most recently in the mNEX spike, which is made by Moderna. It's one of the two COVID vaccines made by Moderna. They both use mRNA technology. The reason why there's interest in this is because it has a lot less mRNA in the lipid particles around it, the fat particles around it. And because of that, it may cause fewer reactions. There's also a lot of interest in it, not for the individual, but for the vaccine in general, because it doesn't require it to be kept as cold as the other vaccines, and you can produce a lot more of it, and it's much more stable. So there's interest from that perspective, but there's also interest that it may cause fewer reactions. We don't really know. The pre-marketing trials suggested that, but we'll really know 6 months from now when we see what it's like after millions of people get vaccinated with this. So that will be very interesting. Whether or not it's better than the other ones in terms of protection, we really don't know. There was some early preliminary data to suggest it might give you a little more protection, but that was so preliminary, I wouldn't count on that at this point. Again, we'll know in about 6 months. So that would be a consideration for mNEX spike. But again, Pfizer's mRNA vaccine, Moderna's other mRNA vaccine, or Novavax, which is not mRNA technology and may give fewer side effects, is something else, is another vaccine to consider. So you've got four good choices there, Eliza, and I think any one of them would be reasonable.
Dr. Swartzberg, there was at one point a theory in circulation that there might be some marginal immunological benefit to switching vaccines. Like apart from any intrinsic qualities of the vaccine itself, mixing and matching so that your immune system has been shown slightly different attack surfaces for the virus and has a more diversified arsenal of tools for responding to it. Has any of that held up in the data? Is there value to following up with a different vaccine from the one you initially got?
It remains a tenable hypothesis. But in terms of really good, solid data, we don't have anything new that I'm aware of that would be a compelling reason to do that. But there's biological plausibility for it. And there was some data to suggest maybe you'd get a little better antibody response, but we don't have anything solid. And I don't think that, I think it's interesting at this point, but I don't think it should change what people want to do in terms of thinking, oh, I can't get the Novavax because I've always had the mRNA vaccines and now I'm not going to have as good a response if I get another mRNA vaccine. I don't think that's the case at all. I, for example, have just gotten the mRNA vaccines every time, sometimes switching between Pfizer and Moderna, depending upon what the pharmacy has.
Bottom line, the best vaccine to get is the one they have available at the time you're due for one.
That's right. You know, there's that old quip that is really true, and that is vaccines don't protect anybody. Vaccination does.
There you go. Dr. Swartzberg, thanks for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. And we ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I'd appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.